This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Dark of Night, A Story of Rot and Ruin by Jonathan Mayberry and Rachel Lavin. This book is read by Ray Porter. Author's Note: This story is a collaboration on several fronts. It is first a collaboration between two writers, myself and talented newcomer Rachel Lavin. It is also a collaboration, or perhaps collision, of three of my fictional worlds, story threads from my zombie apocalypse duology, Dead of Night and Fall of Night, lead us into the tale, but that thread quickly becomes entangled with elements from my Rot and Ruin novels, and also with the Joe Ledger thrillers. You do not need to read those books first, however, in order to read and hopefully enjoy this tale of survival in the days following the rise of the living dead. For those who have read some of all of those books, and for those who enjoy knowing where something falls in the proper chronology, this takes place 15 years after the Joe Ledger books, and 6 months after First Night, the events described in Fall of Night. Those events took place 14 years before Rot and Ruin. Jonathan Mayberry. 1. Des Fox.
"They're coming!"
The child's voice was too loud, too shrill, and Desdemona Fox moved quickly to clamp a hand over the little boy's mouth. The boy struggled, panicking because of what was outside. What was always outside. And because of Des's hold, her strength, the sharp stink of her unwashed body, the blood and dirt on her hands, the gun in her other hand. But Des pulled the boy close, pressing him against her breasts, curving her shoulder around him as if that could keep him safe. Inside the bus, the other children were frozen in postures of listening, their faces transformed into masks of fear and uncertainty. No one made a sound. Everyone held their breath as they listened and waited. The only sounds were outside. Those sounds. Those awful sounds. The slow, artless shuffle and thud of feet against the blacktop. The hiss of cloth as bodies brushed past the sides of the bus. The low, endlessly desperate moans that spoke of bottomless hungers. In the grass alongside this stretch of highway, even the birds and crickets had fallen silent. It had been half a year since these moans began to fill the air, and the animals had learned their lessons. The incautious, insect, bird, and mammal died. The cautious few who survived had learned to be quiet, to be still, to be unheard and unseen. The children inside the bus knew that lesson, too. Even the little boy who now clung to Des, fearing her less than he feared the things passing by. He did not speak again. He barely breathed. The moment stretched and stretched, becoming excruciating.
"How long this time?" wondered Des. "How many?"
And what was happening inside the other buses? She strained to hear, but there were only the dead sounds from outside. The wrong sounds. No screams, no gunfire. Thank God. For now, thank God. Then, nothing. A silence that at first felt filled with promise like a cocked fist, and then emptier, emptier, and then finally empty. Des sagged back, exhaling the air that had burned to poison in her lungs. The little boy looked up at her, his eyes huge and filled with ghosts.
"Are they gone?"
he said, more mouthing the words than speaking them aloud. She pushed him back gently, handing him off to one of the older children, a girl of 11. Des put a finger to her lips and turned so that everyone on the bus saw the gesture. They nodded, those who could nod. Those whose minds could process the signal. Des rose and moved toward the back of the bus. The creatures had been going that way, past them, heading south along the highway, All of the windows on the bus were blocked out, covered with pieces of cloth or cardboard held in place with duct tape. Sloppy, but effective. She waved the kids away, who crouched on the rear bench seat, and they moved without comment, casting frightened looks at the opaque window behind them. The only other adult on the bus, Beale, a former math teacher with a pinched face and a bruised cheek that was fading from purple to yellow, also moved away from Dez. Beale's eyes met hers and immediately flicked away. He was silent. The bruise on his face was a reminder of the least of things that could happen to noisy people. He'd seen Dez kill someone who couldn't keep quiet. Not a kid, though. It had been an adult who they'd picked up along the way, but who was a noisy troublemaker, whiner, and complainer. The kind of person who couldn't hold his tongue, even when it meant drawing the attention of the dead. Dez Fox had warned him twice. On that third time, she hadn't said a word, but had dragged the man to the door of the bus, drove a buck hunting knife into his heart, and threw him out into the road. The following morning, when the caravan had started up, they'd driven over what was left of his bones. Dez moved past the math teacher and knelt on the bench seat. The thick cardboard covering the glass was loose at one corner, held in place with a tiny square of weak Velcro. She peeled it back, careful to minimize the sound, and then peered out. There were at least 40 of them. Mostly men, a few women, all clad in the blood-stained shreds of forest camouflage battle dress uniforms. Their weapons and gear hung from belts and harnesses, or trailed behind them on straps. A few still wore helmets. They all wore the traces of the wounds that had killed them, savage bites that had stolen their lives and futures away, along with flesh and bone. Every single one of them was a soldier.
National Guard, thought Dez. Coming from the north.
Her heart had long since broken, but now the pieces sank to a lower place in her chest. She resealed the window, turned and sat heavily on the bench, lowering her gun. Dez rubbed her tired eyes and felt the wetness of tears. She looked at her fingertips. Then she felt the weight of other eyes and looked up to see so many pale faces staring at her. A few were empty of anything except a lingering and vacuous shock, but most of them held some sparks of hope in their fearful expressions. No one spoke, but those expressions asked the questions, "Are they gone? Are we safe?" How could she answer? How could she even speak? Dez felt immensely weary. She'd been at the heart of this thing, there from the very first bite. She and her partner, J.T. Hammond, had been the officers responding to the first attack. They'd tried to contain it, but even then, even when it was small, it was already racing out of control. When everything fell apart, Dez and a handful of adult survivors had bundled a couple of hundred kids into a convoy of school buses and lit out for Asheville, North Carolina, where there was a rumor of a safe zone. But they'd had to detour time and time again, losing days, then weeks, and finally months. Jammed roads, forest fires, destroyed bridges, washouts, floods, and massive swarms of the hungry dead had forced them to find alternate routes. And then there were the nuclear wastelands created when the military dropped bombs to try and contain the spread.
Dumb fucks!
Thought Dez. All they'd accomplished was to kill the last of the living in those cities and turn them into more of the dead, except now they were radioactive zombies. It only reinforced Dez's belief that humans were too goddamn stupid to survive. She'd lived this long because she was too mad at God to lay down and die, and because there was hope, thin and threadbare, but there. Now, this. This. Dez knew where those soldiers had come from, knew it as surely as if they had spoken to her with their dead voices. The Appomattox River Rescue Station was 20 miles up this road. Dez didn't want to look at the skeletons of the 4 horses and 6 cows they'd used to pull the bus all these months. The animals had made it to within an easy day's walk of the rescue station, and then a swarm of the dead had come out of the woods. Dez and Beale had fought them, but only for a while. They'd killed 36 of the dead, but as that day wore on, more than 200 zombies were drawn to the sound of gunfire. They didn't have enough bullets to win that kind of fight. The horses and cows all died. So, during a lull, Dez and Beale dragged the corpses of the ones she'd killed over to the bus and did her best to stack them around the vehicle. Then they wrapped rags around their own mouths, used bunches of weeds as paintbrushes, and painted the sides of the bus in the black, worm-infested blood of the zombies. They were careful not to get any on their skin. It was horrible work, and they only abandoned it after a fresh wave of the dead came staggering out of the woods. The presence of the rotting corpses and the stink from the tainted blood kept the fresh waves of dead away from the bus. Those creatures were not attracted to putrescence. They only hungered for warm, living flesh. Dez kept her kids safe in the bus, and the nights and days passed in silent horror. They lived in that bus, stretching out their food, trying to ignore the stink of all those kids using buckets for toilets, enduring, weeping silently, screaming into bunched-up jackets so as not to draw down death. In the darkest parts of the night, as wave after wave of zombies passed by, Dez wondered, as she always did, about the other buses. Had any survived? If so, how many? Had Billy survived? Her on-again, off-again boyfriend, Billy Trout, had been in one of the other buses during the storm. She hadn't seen him in more than 5 months. Three times, wandering refugees had told her about seeing groups of children walking with adults along the road, or about buses blackened by fire or splattered with blood. She had no idea if the refugees were mad or accurate, or if these were even the children from Stebbins. Everyone who was alive was fleeing, and a lot of people were headed to Asheville. If the safe zone there was even real, if any of it was real. The Appomattox River Rescue Station was supposed to be real, though. Too many people swore to it. There were signs, freshly painted, all along this road. But now this. The National Guard station had been their only beacon of hope. It was supposed to be maintained by a strong unit of soldiers who had food, shelter, and medical care, and all of it under the protection of tanks and heavy weapons. A fortress that not even the dead could overwhelm. It was up this road. It was in the direction where this pack of zombies had come from. Dez saw the hope in all of those young eyes. She wanted so badly to scream. 2. Rachel L. It was quiet. If there was one thing that Rachel had to identify as the part about the end of the world that she didn't expect, it was the silence. In video games and horror movies, there was always music to announce something bad was going to happen. Bad guys had theme songs and ambient music to build anxiety to big climaxes. She didn't realize how much background noise existed in real life until it was all gone. She didn't realize how alone she was. Now she eagerly waited for the scarce sounds of birds and other animals, anything to keep her company as she walked silently down the freeway, anything to fill the silence, anything but the moans of the dead. Those were the sounds she heard in her nightmares. Those were the sounds she heard while she was awake. Nervously checking her weapons again, she scanned around. The road she was walking down was empty on her side for a while, with abandoned cars stacked up bumper to bumper across the median. Wrecked cars, smashed and burned out in some cases, littered the edges of the road. The wind whistled through the metal, rattling car doors left ajar and fluttering scraps of paper and plastic like leaves. And bodies. There were more bodies than she could bear to count. She avoided getting too close to any of the clusters of cars, the piles of dead. She didn't want to deal with something grabbing her when she wasn't expecting it. It was harder traveling in this world without someone having her back. Rachel wished she'd asked someone to come with her, but she couldn't risk any of them on this trip. They were safe in the hospital. It was probably only going to be a temporary shelter for her group, but it would do, for now at least. They had the supplies they needed, people around, a defense system. Plus, when she came back, she needed a definitive place to meet them, a rally point. If they were wandering, she'd never find them again. Brett wasn't happy she was leaving. In the 2 months it took them to get out of New York and make their careful way south, they'd taken on being co-leaders for the group. They weren't voted in or anything as formal as that. It was just something that had happened naturally. They'd been friends for so long. They were in sync. Even when fighting, they had each other's backs. But she couldn't ask him to leave the group. The group needed him to be there. He was big and powerful. He looked like a hero. And that calmed everyone else. It made them feel safe. Without Brett, Rachel knew there would be panic and chaos. He would keep the group safe. He would keep them all together. However, Rachel knew that Brett was as terrified as everyone else. But she also knew that he was trying to act brave for her. She also knew that acting brave was sometimes enough. Fake it till you make it. She hoped that by leaving him in charge, he would man up, get more confident, become tougher. Like her and some of the others, Brett still wore the hero costume he'd made for Comic-Con. Thor, Prince of Asgard, all leather and lightweight chainmail. Rachel wore her warrior woman costume, also made of leather, reinforced with metal. At first, they kept their costumes because it was nearly impossible to bite through those materials, but now they made a statement to the others in their party and to each of them.
Stay alive.
That's what Brett had said to her before she left, hugging her tightly as if he'd never see her again. She promised him she'd come back alive and in one piece. Nice promise. Easily said. Rachel's hands nervously traced the ridges in her sword as she cast around, walking quickly and silently. In the last months, her sword hadn't left her side. It wasn't the one that had been part of her costume. This one had been scavenged from the hotel room of one of the event's vendors. He'd been a knifesmith who sold everything from Klingon batleth to steel katanas to perfect replicas of the swords from each of the Lord of the Rings movies. The vendor hadn't been in his room, and Rachel had no idea what happened to him. When she and Brett had begun to raid the other hotel rooms for supplies and food, they'd found the cache of weapons. It had been a godsend. Truly. Rachel had collapsed on the floor, clutching an armful of sheathed swords to her chest, and wept. Now she carried one of those swords, an exact but functional replica of the sword carried by the elf lady Arwen in the Fellowship of the Ring. It was a real weapon with a razor-sharp edge, and she had the matching daggers as well. She kept them oiled and honed and ready, and those weapons had saved her life too many times to count. She was not an expert fencer, but that didn't matter. When you're fighting orcs, you don't need finesse and fancy footwork. Rachel favored slashing and working fast, taking them out with shots to the head as quickly as possible, or chopping through their legs and letting the less skilled members of their team finish them with blunt force trauma to the head. Orcs. That's what her group called the Hungry Dead. Easier to think of them as movie monsters because the heroes could always cut their way through armies of orcs. Heroes always won, right? Yeah, maybe, but not always. They'd lost most of their friends in the first day. The rest didn't make it out of New York. There were other cosplayers that had made it out of the Avengers Tower, the hotel where they'd barricaded themselves the first few weeks, and civilians. Lots of civilians. Besides the group of 32 they'd gotten out of the hotel at New York Comic-Con, they'd picked up more and more survivors as they took the trek to New Jersey. But there were more people out there. There had to be. For the few months that they had been at the hospital, they'd sent out small groups, looking for survivors, trying to bring them to safety. After the fall, civilizations had scattered. Cities were dangerous. And from what they could tell, any survivors had vanished into the countryside. There were rumors that there were camps of survivors further out, that the government had safe places they'd set up that hadn't fallen. Survivors meant more people, but no one could give her a definitive answer on where. That's why Rachel had left Brett, had left the group behind at the hospital. It was safe there, hopefully. There was food and power, enough beds for her people, and they'd managed to clear out all of the orcs. It was their haven, at least for now. And she'd send people back. With the world in chaos, there needed to be a safe place for survivors. But she couldn't make this trip with all of them. It would have taken them too long to try to find any survivors and get back, and she couldn't risk their lives. They weren't warriors, the people that they'd saved. They were scared. They would slow her down. And the more people there were, the larger the chances that they would lose some of them. Better she went out alone, find the camps, see if she could find any refugees that she could bring back to the safety of the hospital, or, in turn, make sure there was a safe place that her and her group could stand a chance of starting their lives over again. For someone who never played as a lawful, good character, she really cared too much about saving people. The sound of her boots was muffled against the pavement, and she was keeping a quick pace. Moving alone meant she could travel quickly, rest for shorter times, and hide easily, and since she'd left the hospital, she'd covered a lot of ground. There were roaming hordes of orcs on the road, though whether they were migrating somewhere together like geese or just happened to find each other when the world ended, Rachel didn't know. All Rachel knew was that she wasn't taking on a horde alone. So now she was traveling south as quickly as she could, on a fool's errand. She could tell that's what Brett had thought, though he never said it. Why should she go south, to the unknown, and leave their safe place behind? They had plenty of people here, plenty of food and supplies. How would she ever get back? Would she come back? He didn't say it, but she could see the pain in his eyes. They'd lost everyone else. Now he could lose her, too. The wind carried the faint sound of a groan and the smell of death, and Rachel cast around, drawing her sword from the scabbard on her belt. She squinted into the sunlight ahead, eyeing the hazy silhouette, the hunched shape of a broken body that limped along the cracked pavement. She only saw one, though that didn't mean more weren't out of sight. One she could take. She couldn't let these orcs roam, hurt people, so she cleared them as she could. Rachel walked towards the figure calmly, sword out and ready. It was a solo orc with tangled hair and half of her face tattered to shreds, which lunged at her the moment she got close, a bone-chilling, inhuman sound escaping its throat the moments before Rachel sliced her sword through its head. And then she was alone again in silence. She couldn't think of those orcs as what they'd been before. Rachel was not a killer. Rachel was a survivor, and she was doing what she had to do. But the moment she thought of these things as human beings, she knew she would hesitate, and hesitation would be her death. They were not human. They were monsters, like a video game villain's minions of darkness. Except real. That was the hardest part about all of this. After a life spent role-playing heroes and aliens, after years of live-action role-playing against orcs, monsters, mutants, and bands of killers in handmade costumes, this was real. Real. God. Real. 3. The Ranger and the Dog. "What is it, boy?" murmured the big man. He came to the edge of forest wall and squatted down next to where a huge dog stood. The animal was a mix of white shepherd and Irish wolfhound. 150 pounds of muscle and fang wrapped in strips of leather that were studded with heavy metal washers, bite-proof. The leather was oiled and worked to make it as silent as possible, and the dog, like the man, knew how to move without a sound. A helmet of thick, iron-studded leather was buckled onto the dog's head. It made the animal look like one of the fighting dogs from ancient times. The man was tall, in his 50s, but muscular, with coarse blonde hair that was going gray and blue eyes surrounded by crow's feet. He wore combat fatigue pants and a utility vest over a black T-shirt. The logo of the Army Rangers peaked above the V of the vest. The dog leaned slightly toward the road, his way of pointing, and the ranger narrowed his eyes to peer through the gloom of the woods and the bright sunlight of the midday road. The landscape was in a thousand shades of leaf green, bark brown, shadow gray, and macadam black. But there, in the middle of it, was a bright yellow bus, filthy, streaked with mud or possibly dried blood. The ranger said nothing for a long time, watching the bus. If it had been empty and derelict, the dog would not have hung back out of sight of the road. Something was in there, alive or dead, but unseen. A sound, muffled, a furtive, metallic creak. Someone was opening a door on the far side of the bus. In the still air, the creak sounded loud and alien. The hinges needed grease, and whoever was on that bus needed his ass kicked. Might as well ring the damn dinner bell. The dog stiffened, and the ranger's hand slid to his hip and drew the long knife from its sheath. It was a Marine Corps K-bar fighting and utility knife with a 7-inch straight blade with a clip point. The knife, like the man and the dog, was no virgin. There was another sound, very soft this time, a faint scuff of a shoe on the blacktop. The man and dog remained absolutely still. A figure stepped out from the other side of the bus, moving with caution, creeping around the end of the bus, looking right and left, up and down the empty road. The figure was slim, dressed in filthy, ragged clothes. A girl. The ranger guessed her as 13 or 14, young, but with visible swell of breasts and hips. Maybe pretty in a different version of the world. Now she merely looked young and lost, ragged and absolutely terrified. He could read that in her jerky, uncertain movements, in the bird-like jerk of her head as she tried to look in every direction at once. Scared. The dog uttered the smallest of whines, only loud enough for the man to hear. There was blood on the girl's face, and her shirt was torn, revealing the strap and part of a cup of a functional bra. The ranger tried not to read an even worse story into the state of her clothes. There were a lot of ways in which someone's clothes could get torn out here. Snagging it on a crooked branch, evading the clutching fingers of the dead, lots of ways. He did not want to calculate all of them. His heart was scarred enough already. The girl looked over her shoulder, back at the bus. Then with a small cry, she broke and ran, running across the road away from the bus, not running towards safety. No, she was fleeing from that bus. Shit, growled the big man. And then he was up and running. The girl was headed almost toward him, though he was sure she hadn't seen him or the dog. She was bolting for cover, and a second later it was apparent why. A man's voice punched its way through the still air.
The bitch is getting away! Get her!
The bus rocked on its springs as heavy bodies moved within it, and then four men came running around the end of the bus.
There!
Cried one, pointing, and they tore after the fleeing girl. The men were even filthier than their quarry, each of them dressed in soiled jeans, grimy t-shirts, sneakers. One wore a John Deere billed cap swung backward on his tangled black hair. They had knives on their belts, and one had a machete in his hand. He was the one who'd spotted the girl, and he waved his buddies on with the big flat blade. The girl shrieked and ran faster, veering away from the forest now to try and gain speed on the flat road. It was a bad choice, but then there seemed to have been a lot of bad choices in this kid's life. All of the good choices had been taken away from her by circumstances, bad luck, and men like these. All the hair stood up along the dog's back, and he bared his fangs. His powerful body trembled with savage need.
Baskerville, go, snapped the ranger. Hit, hit, hit.
The dog burst from the woods onto the road and galloped toward the closest of the men, not barking, not howling, making no sounds but the clicking of its nails on the hardtop. The four men did not see the dog until it was almost on them. Then the last man in the string jerked around, seeing the gray monster bearing down on him. He screamed a warning as he tore a hunting knife from his belt. The scream was too late, the knife too small. Baskerville struck the man like a missile, crushing him backward, slamming him down, tearing at him, tearing new screams from him. The other men whirled, seeing the dog and then seeing the figure that was running directly toward them. The man with the machete slapped one of the others on the shoulder.
"Joey, get the bitch,"
he snarled, unimpressed by the middle-aged man.
Zuko and me'll dance this motherfucker.
Joey, a 20-something with fresh scratch marks on his cheeks, pointed to the dog and its victim.
Holy shit, Bob, look at Hank!
Screw Hank, growled the leader. He was never worth shit anyway.
He used his machete to point to the girl who was running up a hill 200 yards down the road.
Go drag that slut back here. We ain't even had a chance to break her in yet. Now get!
Joey, his face ashen as he stared at Baskerville and the red thing on the ground, backpedaled a few paces, then turned and ran off. He was very fast. The ranger slowed to a cautious walk, and one of the other two men tapped the leader.
I got this, Bob,
said Zuko. He was a bull of a man with heavy shoulders, tattooed arms, and a heavy red beard.
Won't you go see about that damn mutt?
The ranger smiled. He had thick blonde hair, blue eyes, and a smile that made him look like the guy who used to play Captain America.
This is the part where I'm supposed to tell you to lay down your weapons, he said, as if this was a reasonable conversation. This is the part where I'm supposed to appeal to your human decency and try to talk you off the ledge so you can reclaim your humanity.
Zuko said, What?
But here's the thing, said the ranger. I already used up today's whole ration of give-a-shit, so, basically, it sucks to be you.
You crazy or something? Growled Zuko.
It's come up in therapy.
The ranger stopped and glanced up the road. Joey was gaining on the girl.
Shit.
He clicked his tongue and the dog suddenly raised his head from what was left of Hank's throat. The ranger pointed with his K-bar.
Save.
It was all he said. The dog barked once and then leapt over the corpse and ran. Bob tried to chop him with the machete, but the dog jagged sideways to avoid the blade and tore past him, racing to catch up with the man and the girl. The ranger turned back to face the remaining men. Zuko was on his left and Bob on his right. Both men were big and strong. Both were decades younger. Both were armed with heavy blades. The ranger was still smiling.
"You put your hands on that girl?"
he asked.
You raped that kid?
Not yet, said Bob, grinning to show yellow teeth. But the day's young.
Just caught her,
agreed Zuko.
Still fresh off the shelf.
You her old man?
Asked Bob.
Or you looking to tear off a piece for yourself?
The ranger's smile, bright as it was, did not reach as far as his eyes. They were cold, blue stones in his weathered face. He nodded toward the bus.
You have any other kids in there?
What's it to you?
Demanded Bob.
Where'd you get that bus? It has Pennsylvania plates.
Zuko shook his head and took a threatening step toward the ranger, who did not flinch or even move.
Why are we talking to this dickhead?
The ranger ignored him and addressed Bob. You boys running with the NKK?
We're not with them,
said Bob quickly.
Really?
Bob,
warned Zuko.
Look at him. He's military. He's with that team out of Farmville, those Free Scouts.
Not exactly, said the ranger. But they're stand-up guys. Met a bunch of them last week, and they said there were two or three teams of NKK dickheads working this stretch of highway.
Bob said nothing, but Zuko actually put his left hand behind his hip. It was a bit late, though. The words, New Klux Klan, had been visible through the dirt on his skin.
For the record, said the ranger, New Klux Klan is probably the stupidest name I've ever heard, and I've heard some real corkers.
Yeah, well, kiss my ass, snapped Bob. It means something.
It means what exactly? Please, tell me, I'm fascinated.
Bob sneered.
People think the world went all to hell because of some plague or bioweapon, but that ain't it. This is God testing us. He saw us fuck everything up by letting kikes and niggers and wetbacks take over, and this is how he's going to set it all right. He shook things up just like when that flood thing happened. When this is all over, there ain't going to be nothing but pure whites running this world, and we'll live like kings.
The ranger burst out laughing.
Holy shit! Seriously? You believe that shit, or are you messing with me?
It's the way it is, growled Zuko. It's the way it should be.
You're saying that inbred mouth breathers are the meek who are supposed to inherit the earth?
We ain't meek, we're the chosen people.
Oh, so you're Jews.
What?
Jews. They're the chosen people. I seem to have read that somewhere in a book. He snapped his fingers. What was it called now? Oh, yeah, the Bible.
You mocking us?
Asked Bob, brandishing his machete. Yes, I thought that was clear, said the ranger. What with my mocking tone and all.
You're gonna laugh out of the other side of your face,
began Bob, but his words were cut off by the sound of a terrible high-pitched scream that came rolling at them down the road. It was chased by the echo of a deep-chested howl of red triumph.
Oh, Jesus,
murmured Zuko.
Joey.
Personally, said the ranger, I doubt you cats have Jesus on speed dial. He moved into them. The K-bar rose, blurred, became fluid, moved like light as it knocked aside the other blades and filled the air with glittering rubies. Bob and Zuko simply ended. One moment they were there, big, deadly, feral, and the next they were disconnected pieces of meat that no longer looked human. The smile never left the ranger's face, and it never reached his cold blue eyes. He stepped back and went still, listening to the air. The echo of Baskerville's howl had not even finished bouncing off the trees. The killing of these two men was nothing. A moment out of his life, and he turned away from them without further thought. He ran to the bus, circled it, saw the open door, and went inside. There was no one else in there. However, there was a line of 18 human scalps hung above the driver's seat. Some of the hair was fine, the way a child's hair is. The smile leaked away from his face and he sagged against the dashboard.
Oh, Christ,
he breathed. Then he backed off the bus, turned and ran up the road to find Baskerville and to find the girl.
4. Dez Fox. Dez heard Beale step down from the bus.
Were they?
Began the math teacher. Then he faltered. Dez turned to watch him as he looked at the retreating backs of the dead soldiers and then looked the other way, toward the Appomattox River rescue station. Dez waited for him to say something else, but all she heard was a tiny noise that might have been a whimper. She scanned the woods. Route 625 ran through dense woods, but the last 6 months without road crews cutting back the weeds had resulted in a riot of growth. Weeds, creeper vines, kudzu, and tall grasses grew all the way to the edge of the blacktop and sprouted up in every crack. If things didn't turn around, then this road would vanish completely in 10 years. Mother Nature was a hungry and relentless bitch, she knew. Then she wondered if that would be a good thing or bad. Ever since the fucking brain trust in the military dropped all those nukes, which in turn hit everything with electromagnetic pulses, none of the vehicles worked. The fleet of buses she'd taken out of Stebbins were dead. One here and the others God knew where. They'd been separated during a bad, bad night, long ago. A storm raged throughout this part of the state, and the bombs, nuclear and fuel air, had chased tens of thousands of people into their path. The drivers of the other buses had panicked as rivers of people and zombies swept toward them. Some of them took side roads, some just disappeared. And then all the engines died as the EMPs played their dirty, backstabbing trick. The zombies were gone now, and the road was clear. The woods were still, too. If it wasn't for all the rotting corpses, it would be a pretty day in the country, she thought. Blue sky, sunshine, a few puffy white clouds. Appomattox was 20 miles from here. She could make it in less than 6 hours. Dez was leaned down to rawhide and whipcord. She could haul ass, and even dumb as he was, Beale could defend a closed bus for a day. There were smart kids on that bus, and they'd learned how to be quiet. Could she risk leaving them for half a day? That had been her plan, to button up the bus and head out alone, find some buff young guardsmen and get them to come back with lots of balls and bullets
to rescue the kids and save the day.
Shit,
she said. Beale came and stood next to her.
What do we do now?
Dez sighed. It was noon or a little after. Lots of daylight left. She could make it to the rescue station long before dark. But why bother? Why frigging bother?
Dez,
prodded Beale. She wanted to slap him. Not because he was speaking out of turn. He wasn't. It was a reasonable question. But because it might make her feel better.
I don't know,
she said.
We have to do something.
Let me think,
she said quietly. But before she could come up with anything resembling a plan, there was a sound off to her left. She and Beale turned. It was there, deep in the woods, still hidden by the tall weeds. Even unseen, though, they knew what it was. They heard it, the crashing of heavy bodies moving clumsily through the overgrown foliage, and the moans. Those terrible moans, lifted from a dozen dead throats. No, more than that. Dozens. Or hundreds. Dez closed her eyes. If the kids weren't in the bus, if they didn't need her, there were ways to shut off those sounds. Rush into them and tear down as many as she could before there was nothing left of her, or ride a bullet into the big black. There were always doorways out. Staying alive had fewer options, even when there was no real hope left. Dez Fox opened her eyes, turned, and gave Beale a shove toward the bus.
Go,
she said. He did. She followed. And the dead came. 5. Rachel L. Night. Rachel found a sheltered spot with good concealment that also allowed her good lines of sight and escape. She strung tripwires, caught and cleaned a young rabbit, found water from a stream, and built a fire. The woods were filled with sounds, which she took as a good sign. Silence meant danger. But night meant waiting. Night meant another day away from Brett during which something could have happened. Another day their group could have been attacked. Another night that the world would fall further into chaos. The longer this trip took, the more she was beginning to lose hope, though she wouldn't voice it to herself out loud. She hadn't seen any signs of survivors after leaving the hospital, and now she was somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Virginia, though exactly how far through the state she wasn't sure. The map she'd found in a rest stop was confusing to read, and she was used to nav systems and Google Maps. Reading old-fashioned paper maps was never a skill she'd thought she'd need to learn. She would keep following 95 all the way to North Carolina, and then she'd turn back, find a different route home, and try to see whom she could find. Alone during the long hours of darkness, trying to keep her mind from pulling her down into negativity, her thoughts drifted to the past, to her family.
"We're... your aunt and I... we're headed south... North Carolina."
That fractured message, distorted by failing phone signals, was the last thing Rachel had heard from her mom. Rachel had tried to call her the day the world went to hell, and after the third try had managed to get through, but the connection was bad and the call got dropped quickly. Rachel had been left with a dead line and, "I love you, Mom," left on her lips. It had been 6 months since her phone battery had died. Everyone else had ditched their phones. They were useless now. Rachel hadn't been able to give hers up. She kept holding on to the hope that they'd find somewhere with power, that the towers would work again. It was silly and pointless, but her phone was her lifeline in the world before, and here in the world after, she wouldn't leave it. Rachel played with her iPhone absentmindedly, flipping it over between her hands as she stared into the small fire she'd built. The last birds dove through the air, reveling in the early spring. It was still just cold enough that she needed to wrap herself in the wool and fur cloak she'd found in one of the rooms in the Avengers Tower, and days of exhaustion from walking and uneasy sleep were adding up, weighing her lids. She needed to find somewhere to sleep, somewhere with doors that locked. but that sounded like it required more effort than she wanted to give that moment. So instead, she closed her eyes just for a moment, wishing she had a shot of espresso or a 5-hour energy. She was going to make sure she grabbed those the next time she saw any. She conjured images of her mother in her mind. The ache was immense, and even all this time hadn't dulled the pain. She tried not to cry in front of Brett or the others, but now, alone, out here where no one could see, the tears came in a flood. Sobs broke in her chest with the intensity of bare-knuckle punches. She caved forward with her face in her hands and wept for all that she had lost. She missed the change in the woods. She did not hear the birds fall silent. Rachel was unaware of anything until the dead weight that slammed into her from behind and the pinch of teeth on her arm. 6. The Ranger and the Dog. The ranger left the dead behind and ran up the road, following the baying of his dog. Baskerville could sound a lot like a wolf when he wanted to. The hound was mostly silent in the heat of a fight, but when the killing was done, he liked to tell the world. It was the dog's only bad habit, but in a world of the savage dead, and even more savage living, it was a habit that the ranger was trying very hard to break. He climbed up the steep slope of the highway and plunged down the other side, but slowed to a quick walk within 100 yards of the crest. What was left of Joey littered the center of the road. Baskerville could act like a puppy and sometimes like a clumsy goof, but not in combat. Like the ranger himself, there was a switch that doused all interior light and left only something dark and predatory, something more savage than the dead. Not cruel, but thorough in its desire to destroy. In that way, Baskerville was very much like both of his grandparents, a combat white shepherd and a fierce but strange Irish wolfhound. The shepherd, whose name had been Ghost, had walked through the Valley of the Shadow with the ranger on countless missions. Back when the ranger had been a captain in a covert special ops group called the Department of Military Sciences. The wolfhound, Banshee, had been bred by a group of women called Arclight, and they had bred some bizarre qualities into the dog. The pups of Ghost and Banshee had each been powerful and individual, and each of them had gone into combat too. Baskerville was still young, but all of the intelligence, instinct, and ferocity of his forebears was fully alive in him. As alive as Joey was dead. The ranger flicked a quick look at the corpse, noting the type of damage Baskerville had done, looking for what he called recreational damage, as opposed to wounds inflicted to win the fight. There was definitely some of that. Baskerville sometimes went too far, dismembering a kill even if it wasn't food. It was something the ranger would have to work on, and for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, he wanted the dog to be a soldier and not a monster. And second, he needed to trust the animal. He knew from dealing with his own personal damage and inner demons that the killer within needed to be kept on a leash. Baskerville stood on the shoulder of the road, body pointed toward the woods, head turned to watch the ranger approach. The hound did not wag his tail or romp around. He stood like a statue, eyes fixed, mouth smeared with fresh blood. "Where?" asked the ranger. The dog turned and looked off into the forest and then back at the ranger. "Find," said the man. "My pace." The dog woofed once, very softly. He always did that, a habit from his grandfather. Ghost had been able to understand a huge number of verbal commands and always seemed to answer with that woof. A strange and wonderful animal, and Baskerville had all of his best qualities and some of his grandmother's more dangerous and enigmatic traits. "A weird dog for a weird world," mused the ranger. The dog began to move, but then the ranger said, "Wait." He knelt beside the animal, tore off a thick handful of grass, and used it to wipe most of the blood away from the animal's muzzle and fur. Baskerville endured it with all of the bad grace of a child getting chocolate wiped from his face. He even contrived to roll his eyes with exasperation. "Stop it," complained the ranger. "You want to scare that kid even more than she is." He finished and stood, then clicked his tongue once. Baskerville moved off immediately.
The ranger looked up and down the road once more, and then followed. 7. Rachel L. Rachel was stunned for a moment as she hit the ground hard, but she reacted as adrenaline surged, using her legs to push the orc off, twisting her arm out of its teeth. It struggled to its feet, but she was faster, rolling over her shoulder into a crouch, dragging her dagger and holding it ready. She lunged forward, swinging her arm down to try to drive the knife through the orc's skull, but her sharp metal blade bounced off, slicing through rotting skin, but not penetrating the thick bone. Crying out in frustration as the orc reached out for her with ragged nails, not fazed by her attack, Rachel struggled to push it back, this time driving the dagger down hard through the softer bone at the top of the skull. As it slumped to the ground, so did she, hands shaking from adrenaline. Then she sat up, her hands running over her arm with feverish intensity to make sure that her leather bracer had held. The teeth marks were indented in the thick leather, but nothing broke through, and she almost wept with relief. But she couldn't sit long. One orc meant more were close behind. She learned early on that orcs seemed to find each other, traveling in hordes, a wave of disease and death washing over the world. Using her boot to shovel dirt over the fire, Rachel tugged her bags back over her shoulders, then buckled her knives and swords back on. She took a moment to stare down at the orc, the rotted skin peeling back from the mouth and forehead, unseeing eyes staring past her face into the unknown. It didn't feel real. It still felt like a video game, like she was in a very realistic virtual reality, that when it got to be too much, she could press start and go back to reality. Her cell phone had fallen into the dirt, and she picked it up gently, brushing the dust from the screen and tucking it into a pocket on her bag. One day, she'd leave the phone behind. One day she'd give up her hope to return to the world before. Today was not that day. Back on the road, Rachel tugged her bag up over her shoulders, eyes casting around as she tried to find a sign for where she was, what direction to head in. Some of the signs on I-95 had suffered significant damage, and she constantly had to compare her old paper map with fallen signs and old landmarks. Rachel had driven this road a couple of times over the years, on family road trips or trips with her friends. Things looked so different from car windows, like a movie. Rachel passed a rest stop, a flicker of a memory from long ago, a kid from a different life peering out the dark car windows over her Game Boy. There was trash scattered around here now, fallen fences and abandoned cars. It looked so different, like something she recognized but also unrecognizable, like that feeling you get in a dream when you know something, but it's not exact. There were a handful of orcs wandering around, and Rachel cleared them quickly, her sword a blur as it hissed through the air, bodies slumping to the ground. Inside the rest stop, there was nothing standing, though bodies of fallen dead scattered around in heaps. Stepping around them carefully, Rachel grabbed a few bags of chips and some candy from the store, tucking a few 5-hour energies into her pack. Turning to leave, she noticed something written on the wall of the information center. It was hard to see, though it looked like it had been purposely wiped off and distorted. Half of a map taped to the sign was ripped, a few pieces lying around the floor, but it looked like the start of a circle, or some sort of writing on the map. Maybe that's where there were survivors? Could the information center be the place that someone had posted directions to a safe zone? Squinting at the wall, the smudged-out letters, she could make out part of the words, Apama-ri-er-re-stash. Picking up the few pieces of map paper she could find, Rachel pieced them together, carefully, on the table. Some of the crucial pieces were missing, but she could tell a general direction. Somewhere off the next exit, there seemed to be something. She could see the edges of a circle drawn on the map, though what city or landmark they identified was lost, but maybe there would be more signs as she headed that way. She pulled out her map and scoured it for anything that might contain the words written on the wall. The font was so small it was hard to read, and she pulled the map as close to her face as possible as she looked for anything any hints at all. Finally, something caught her eyes. Appomattox River Rescue Station. That had to be it. It was in about the same place that the shredded map had indicated something. Copying as much of the information onto the new map as she could, she tucked that into a pouch at her waist, heading back onto the road and looking for a sign of an exit. She wasn't sure how long that information had been there. She had no proof that it was actually legitimate, but for now she had nothing else to go on. This was the first sign of possible life, first hint of a location of people, and she was going to take it and hope for the best. Turning off the next exit, avoiding the pileups of cars and bodies cautiously, she turned her eyes to the horizon. There was at least a chance of survivors, a chance there would be someone out there. She just hoped she wasn't too late.
8. Des Fox. It took half an hour for the swarm of dead to pass by. It felt like 10 hours. Beale huddled down with the kids, both giving and taking comfort, while Des crouched by the front of the bus and peered out through a peephole. Some of the dead came down the road from the direction of the rescue station. More soldiers, but also quite a few ordinary folk. Farmers and people dressed in whatever clothes they wore when they died. There was no uniformity to what the citizens wore, either, nor was there any particular variety. In movies about the end of the world, there were usually people dressed as clowns, as nuns, as bakers, as convenience store clerks, like that, each different so that the filmmakers could make some kind of statement. Not here. These zombies were just people. Unique in that they had each been an individual with a life, a future, a past, an identity, but turned homogeneous in death. They were all hungry, all torn, all ragged, all beginning to rot, all undead. And all of them would have battered their way through the cracked windows of the old school bus if they knew what was inside. From the oldest to the youngest, the strongest to the weakest, they would become an attacking army. Only the rotting flesh of their own kind made them pass by without pausing, without noticing, without knowing. These thoughts shambled through Dez's mind with the same slow, deliberate gait as the zombies. She had never been the top student in her class, except in the army and the police academy. In school, she'd been a C student, cruising the edges of frequent suspension and likely expulsion. But that did not mean she was not a thinker. The long hours of the nights since the fall of man had given her so much time to brood and ponder that she now considered herself a philosopher on the nature and specifics of the apocalypse. A new field of study, and one in which she could hold her own as an expert against anyone. That thought, though, made her immediately think of Billy Trout. He'd broken the story of the rogue bioweapon that had caused all this. His live broadcasts placed on YouTube and blasted through social media had focused the eyes of the world on Stebbins County. His pleas for mercy had kept the town from being thoroughly sterilized, including the school where the last of the living had been hiding. And afterward, when the convoy of buses had set out, he stopped several times each day to give updates on the fall. "This is Billy Trout, reporting live from the apocalypse." It had almost been a joke, except that no one thought it was funny. Where was Billy? He was the real thinker. He was the one who had always been in touch with his emotions, more so than Dez, who'd always mocked him for it. She would give so much to have him back here right now, to hear his voice, even if he was saying something that made her mad. She'd even sit through a whole day of his liberal politics if it meant having him back, if it meant knowing he was alive. Damn. Outside, a last zombie staggered out of the woods, a fat woman walking on a shattered foot, limping slower than the others, straggling behind.
"Come on, you stupid cow,"
muttered Dez, too quiet even for the huddled kids to hear. The dead woman fell to her knees, took an excruciating time getting back to her feet, walked 5 steps, fell, got up, rinse, repeat. It took nearly 15 minutes for the crippled corpse to walk to the crest of the hill. Dez relaxed by very slow degrees. She went to the back of the bus to watch the lame zombie vanish over the hill, then to the front again to make sure that one really was the last. It was. For now, at least. The children sat in silence, none of them visibly reacting to the end of the immediate threat. They were becoming too weary to even show their fear. More than half of them had fallen asleep. A naive person, Dez knew, would look at those sleeping bodies and think that it was a sign of the resilience of youth. Dez would want to smack that person for being an idiot. These kids were so deep into habitual shock that they were retreating into exhausted sleep, and that sleep was in no way refreshing. Dez moved past the small bodies and tapped Beale on the shoulder and nodded to the door. He followed her outside, and they walked a few paces away from the bus.
"Look," she said. "There were a bunch of farmers in that last batch, and I saw some yesterday, too."
"So what?"
asked Beale.
"So this is farm country or near enough to it."
"Again, so what? If you're thinking about holing up inside a farmhouse, then you're nuts. It didn't keep the farmers from getting killed."
"Maybe,"
she said.
"And maybe they tried to make a fight of it, or went running to help neighbors and got bit, whatever. This bus is getting rank, and we're nearly out of food. Most farmers have stores of stuff, and they have rain barrels, and a barn could be reinforced pretty easily. They're stronger than houses and don't have as many windows."
"So you're suggesting what? That we take the kids on a class trip to some hypothetical farm somewhere? Those woods are full of the dead."
"No, Einstein, that's not what I'm saying," she snapped. "I'm saying I go looking for a farm. Me. I can move faster alone. I can scout around and come back."
"What if you don't find anything?"
"Then I'll try a different direction tomorrow morning, and somewhere else tomorrow afternoon, and I'll keep trying until I find something better than a rusting tin box on an open road."
Beale looked badly shaken at the thought.
"You'd leave us alone?"
"Not for long. I'd be out a couple hours at a time. You stay here and keep the bus buttoned up. You can do that, can't you?"
You can do that,"
she repeated, putting a more encouraging stress on her words.
"Come on, man, you've done this a lot of times. You're a pro, and I won't be far away. If the shit really hits the fan, fire a shot and I'll hear it. But only do that if things are going totally south. Don't do it just because you get spooked. You hear me?"
He nodded. It was a quick, nervous, uncertain nod, though. Dez flashed him her very best smile and patted him on the shoulder.
"That's my man."
Beale actually blushed. Dez went back to the bus, stuffed the last two full magazines for her Glock into a pocket, slung a water bottle over her shoulder, and left without saying a word. The kids didn't even seem to notice, or care, or anything. At the edge of the forest, she turned and waved to Beale, who stood in the doorway of the bus. He lifted one uncertain hand and then fled inside and closed the door.
"Jesus,"
Dez breathed.
"What am I doing?"
She turned and ran into the woods. Dez wasn't sure what to expect or if there would be anything worth finding. Most of this area was state forest, but there had been farmers. A lot of farmers. There had to be farms. The sun scorched a hot line across the afternoon sky as she put mile after mile between her and her kids. 9. Rachel L. After a few long hours spent walking off of the exit, Rachel stopped to rest. She shrugged off the backpack and let it fall, and then slumped down with her back to a burned-out shell of a state police cruiser. The woods and road were quiet except for insect and bird sounds. That was good. That was safe. Her rest period lasted less than a minute. The quiet was suddenly shattered by the frantic sound of whinnying, which was nearly a scream in the silence. A horse?
"God!"
she cried as she jumped to her feet, grabbed her bag, and instantly took off running after the sound. There was something else alive in this area besides her, and she was going to find it.
It didn't take her long to track the sound. It was close and it was in trouble. Rachel knew that she was running into danger, but the cry of that horse mattered more. It touched something deep inside her. Not far beyond the trees were acres of fenced fields, the long grass rustling in the wind. Ducking under the posts, Rachel moved swiftly toward the barn in the center, scanning around nervously for possible threats. She could see movement along the side of the barn and pulled at one of her daggers, creeping closer silently. There were orcs, though she couldn't tell if the smell was from them or from the barn, a handful of them that were trying to reach through the open barn windows. There was no way they could get into the barn. The fields were fenced and gates locked, and the big barn door led directly into the fields. There was at least one horse in the barn, though. Rachel could hear it. Though why it didn't just leave the barn, she wasn't sure. Using the pommel of her dagger, she banged it against the metal gate, the hollow clanging unnervingly loud.
"Over here, you ugly lumps!"
Rachel yelled, continuing to hit metal on metal. The orcs, distracted by the sudden and new sound, turned to stumble towards her, lunging with moldy hands reached out for her, flesh and sinew hanging from bone. Pulling her elven dagger out of her belt, she waited until the first one was within arm's reach, then drove the dagger into the back of its skull. It crumpled to the ground as the second and third one reached the gate. She cleared the group without any problems, holding her breath as the rancid smell washed over her, breathing out her mouth and fighting to keep down the power bar she'd eaten earlier. Wiping the thick black blood on the grass, she kept it in hand just in case and moved over to the barn, cautiously. The frantic cries of the horse had stopped, though she could still hear the hooves against the hard floor and deep snorting. Could a horse become infected? Rachel hadn't come across many animals since New York, and a mental image of a half-decomposed horse carrying an orc across a field as if it were riding into battle flashed across her eyes. It was almost comical, something absurd from a corny movie, but she shook that off quickly. This wasn't a movie, and if animals could become infected, there was a whole lot of new problems they were going to run into. Dead humans were bad enough. Dead wolves were terrifying. She peeked around the corner hesitantly, worried about what she might find. The horse was halfway down the barn, watching her with wild eyes. Living eyes. Tucking her knife into her belt, she put her hands up in front of her, trying to calm the horse. It tried to back away, but the lead kept it in place. Rachel didn't need to imagine the horrors that this horse had seen in the last year. It probably thought she was going to try to hurt it.
"Shh, it's okay."
Rachel slowly inched her bag off her back and reached in, scouting for an apple. Taking a bite out of it and putting it in her hand, she moved closer to the horse, hand out, trying to tempt it with the treat. Its nostrils were flaring, watching her with panic, but it let her come closer.
"Look, look, it's an apple. You remember apples?"
she asked in a calming voice, standing still with her hand out. The horse's ears flicked forward at the word apple. Rachel didn't move, letting the horse come to her. Its brown hair was matted and fur caked with mud and dried blood, but it looked to be in one piece. No gashes, cuts, or bites. Pablo, she already mentally named him Pablo after a horse she'd rode when she was a kid, shifted back and forth nervously, ears flicking, watching her every move, but let her approach, taking the bit of apple and munching on it eagerly.
"This isn't going to be easy," she said to him quietly. "It's going to be scary and dangerous. It's not a good place out there anymore. But I'm going to find survivors, and I'm going to find a safe place for everyone, okay? And we're going to make it a good world again."
Pablo nickered softly, and she stroked his neck, gently, calming him. Rachel was relieved. Luck was on her side today. On horseback, she could move faster, cover more ground. She could find survivors and get back to Brett and their group easily.
"It's okay. See? We can stop the world from ending. We'll make it all okay."
10. The Ranger and the Dog. They moved through the wood with practiced ease, the dog leading and the man following. They went as fast as caution would allow, and not one step faster. There were no screams in the forest, which was encouraging. But Baskerville suddenly stopped and looked off to his left, not in the direction they'd been following. The ranger drew his fighting knife and crouched beside the dog, touching the animal's side in order to read the degree of tension. Baskerville was trembling. The dog did not fear the living, not at all, but when there were zombies around, the animal shivered like this. Even Baskerville feared the dead, and the ranger could understand why. Unlike human enemies, the dog could not use its fearsome fangs against the zombies. Canine instincts, or maybe it was some kind of prescience, the ranger didn't really know, made the dog fear the blood of the zombies. There were parasites in that black blood, tiny thread-like white worms, and they were the true monsters of this apocalypse. Genetically modified larvae that carried a chemical witch's brew cooked up in a Cold War bioweapons lab long ago. Lucifer 113. Conceived by Soviet scientists and then remodeled by a deranged prison doctor here in the U.S. Madness on all sides, and when the devil had slipped its chain, the world was consumed. Baskerville could not know or understand any of that, but it had a strong reaction to the presence of the dead. It would smash into them, knock them down, but it wouldn't bite. And the dog was even careful not to walk in spilled black blood. It's why Baskerville was still alive. It's why the ranger was still alive. They were a team. Baskerville was the best weapon against living human foes or against the packs of feral dogs that roved these woods, but it was the ranger who fought and killed the zombies. The ranger tapped the dog's shoulder once. A question. Close? Baskerville did not react, which was the answer. No. Or at least not close enough to be an immediate threat. Nearby, though. The dog shivered, wanting to get away, so the ranger rose and used his knee to gently nudge the animal back toward the path they were following. Baskerville lingered a moment longer, giving an uncertain look to the dense forest, and then turned, sniffed to recapture the girl's scent, and took off. The ranger slid his knife back into its sheath and followed. The forest was a series of densely wooded hills with a few small streams cutting through it. The slopes and gullies were nothing to the dog, but the man felt his leg muscles begin to burn as he moved. He was 50, not 20, and this kind of thing was a young man's game. Once upon a time, he would have run 20 miles of this for fun. But as he saw it, that ship sailed, hit an iceberg, caught fire, and sank. Now he felt every one of his years, every inch of scar tissue, every bit of calcification on broken bones. The kid they chased, though, must have been a marathon runner before the damned apocalypse. She was well ahead and seemed able to go through holes in the shrubbery where a rabbit wouldn't have tried. Great natural athleticism will do that. So will stark terror. Baskerville suddenly shot forward faster as the ground leveled out into an overgrown farm cornfield. As the ranger raced to catch up, he saw the clear marks of small, sneakered feet in the dirt. Ahead there was a rustling of something moving fast through the tall weeds. "Circle," he called out, and Baskerville cut suddenly left and really poured it on. He vanished into the corn but went wide to try and get in front of the fleeing girl. The girl was fast, but the dog was faster. The ranger heard her voice rise in a sudden shriek. The girl had encountered the dog. The ranger moved into the cornfield, but he slowed his pace, then paused to call out. "Girl," he said, pitching his voice to be heard, but keeping urgency out of it. "Hey, kid. Don't be afraid. My dog won't hurt you, and neither will I." There was no sound, no answer. "Those guys back there? They can't hurt you anymore." Nothing. "I'm a soldier," he called. "My name is Captain Joe Ledger. My dog's name is Baskerville, and he will not hurt you. We just want to help." There was silence in the cornfield, but the ranger, Ledger, thought it was different. A listening stillness. "Please," he called. "I know you're scared. You're smart to be scared. I'm scared, too.
but I'm a soldier and a father, and I won't let anyone hurt you. More silence, except for the soft rustle of the corn. Then a voice spoke. Young, trembling, frightened. Female.
Leave me alone.
Ledger inched forward. I can't, sweetheart. You're alone out here, and there are more of those NKK freaks out there. You're safer with Baskerville and me.
I can take care of myself,
she said, and there was some iron mixed in with the fear. Not alone, kid. Heck, I don't even travel alone, and I used to be with Special Forces. He had her exact location pegged now, 40 feet in and slightly to his right.
Go away,
she yelled. Can't do it, darling, he said. We good guys have to stick together.
I don't need your help.
Yeah, you do. There's some shamblers in the woods, and they're coming this way, and when the rest of the NKK nutbags see what happened to their boys, they're going to come hunting.
I didn't do that. You did.
He moved closer, but he lowered his voice a little to disguise the fact. Sure, I did that. But they won't know that. They're going to come looking for someone to hurt. She sobbed.
Please! Why can't you people just leave us alone?
Us. Did she mean the innocent? Or women in general? Or was she with a party? Ledger guessed that it was a bit of all three. Look, kid, I'm coming to you. I won't hurt you.
Don't.
I have to. Like I said, it's not safe out here.
You're one of them,
he sighed. No, I'm really not. Ledger moved through the corn, doing it slow and making noise, so she heard, so she knew.
Please,
she whimpered. He found her in a small clearing. Baskerville sat watching her from 10 feet away. The girl was a year or so older than he'd first thought, maybe 14, but slim and undernourished. Her clothes were in rags, and she had bruises on her face and arms. There were broken pieces of leaves and twigs in her filthy hair, and she sat huddled, shivering with exhaustion and terror. But there was fire in her eyes, though, and she clutched a sharp stone in one hand, ready to fight, expecting to have to. Ledger knelt at the edge of the clearing. Listen to me, he said quietly. I understand that you're terrified, and I know you don't know me from a can of paint, but I won't hurt you.
That's what they said.
And they lied. I bet a lot of people have lied to you. Your parents probably told you there were no monsters, but there are. The boogeyman is real, and sometimes he's cold and dead, and sometimes he's alive, like those freaks back there, but I'm not one of them. She eyed him with enormous suspicion, the rock ready to strike. Ledger crossed his legs and sat. He removed his knife from its sheath and tossed it lightly to land in front of her. It's better than a rock. The girl dropped the rock and snatched up the knife, raised it, held it ready to stab. Baskerville went, woof, but did not move. Where are you from, kid? Asked the ranger.
I'm not a kid,
she snapped. Okay, sorry. Where are you from, miss? She said,
Richmond.
Your family got out before they dropped the bombs? The girl said nothing, but after a moment she nodded. Are they still around? Your folks? The girl shook her head. A single bright tear fell down her dirty cheek. How? He asked. The walkers, or... She sniffed back her tears.
Them. The dead ones.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Another family took me in. We were together until... Until...
She stopped, and Ledger didn't ask for details. They'd both heard enough horror stories. Retelling them only did harm. I was overseas when it started, he said. On a job. I'm with... Was with... The military, like I said. Things all went crazy while we were half a world away. By the time we got back, everything was falling apart. I tried to get home, you know? My wife and our kid had gone to my uncle's place in Maryland. Nice big farm, lots of land, away from the cities. He shook his head. After a long minute, the girl asked,
What happened? He sighed again.
It took me too long to get home. You know how it is. The roads, the crowds, the walkers, the nukes. By the time I made it to my uncle's place, there was nothing but burned fields and ashes where his house was.
Your family? Were they in the... you know?
Ledger shook his head. No, there were no bones. I looked. God help me, I really looked. And the thing is, I don't even know if my wife made it to my uncle's place or not. Communication was lousy even in the first few days. I know she was going there, but that's all I know.
What did you do?
The girl still held the knife, but no longer raised to strike. Instead, she clutched it to her chest. Baskerville laid down and placed his big head on his front paws.
I think I went a little crazy, said Ledger. I looked everywhere I could.
Went to every refugee camp and rescue station. Spent months doing that.
And then there was a while where I think I was out of my head.
Baskerville whined softly as if he understood.
He helped me get through it all, said Ledger. Big goof of a dog gave me a reason to keep moving, keep fighting, keep going.
The girl looked at the dog for a moment. If Ledger had wanted to, he could have reached over and plucked the knife out of her hand, but he did not.
His name's Baskerville, like in the book?
Yep. The girl nodded and they sat for a moment. A breeze stirred the corn and starlings flew overhead.
Lindsay,
she said. What? Asked Ledger.
My name's Lindsay. Lindsay Brewer Munoz.
Ledger smiled. Good to know you, Lindsay Brewer Munoz.
You're Mr. Ledger?
Captain Joseph Edwin Ledger, he said. My friends call me Joe. She nodded, but did not repeat his name.
How long have you been alone?
He asked. Her answer was a stubborn shake of the head. It wasn't information she wanted to share. Not yet. He accepted that, letting her set the rules.
When did you meet those NKK lame brains?
Lindsay looked away and down.
This morning, only a couple hours ago, I ran away and...
She shook her head again.
They didn't mess with you? He asked.
No, they were...
She didn't finish the sentence, and he didn't need to know what threats or promises the dead man had made.
They're gone, he said.
Lindsay turned slowly and stared at him. She had very green eyes.
You killed all of them? All four?
We did, corrected Joe, nodding to Baskerville. And I'm sorry if you saw any of it.
Good,
she said, and her pretty young face instantly became a mask of such utter hatred that Ledger almost recoiled. It saddened him, hurt him deeply to see so much contempt on a young woman's face, on any human face. It hurt worse to know that this girl would live with the knowledge of what almost happened to her and have to bear the fear of the very real possibility of it happening in the future. Her innocence, or a chunk of it, had already been stolen from her. She would never again be able to believe that the world was not, at least in part, a truly vile place. And Ledger wanted very badly to put that genie back in the bottle, to seal it up, to make it not so. But the world was the world. Wishing for a better one wasn't going to change what had already happened. He said,
I'm sorry.
The girl held onto the knife, and the moment, ugly and raw, stretched and stretched. Suddenly Baskerville leapt to his feet. At the same moment Ledger heard the sounds coming from off to their left, the swish of corn stalks, and the moans. He shot to his feet, too. Stay close, he ordered. There were more moans now, from their right, and more in front of them. The dead were coming from all sides.
Oh, God!
Cried Lindsay, and still clutching the knife, she broke and ran into the cornfield, vanishing from sight.
11. Rachel L. Rachel and Pablo walked beneath a canopy of green trees. The road seemed to never end, though the signs for the river station were becoming more and more frequent, and newer-looking the further she traveled, which Rachel took as a sign she was moving in the right direction. But she still hadn't seen any people, any survivors, which concerned her. It had been over a week since the last living person she'd run into, and she'd hoped the closer she got to some sort of sanctuary, the more survivors she'd find. Had the world slipped further into chaos? Was she the only one left out here, like a Twilight Zone episode gone horribly wrong?
"Please let this be the right way. Please let there be people there. Let this not have been completely in vain."
A sound rang out, deafening, startling Rachel in the silence. A gunshot.
"People!"
Her heart began hammering, and hope, that lovely, dangerous thing, flared in her chest. There were survivors somewhere nearby. In trouble? Or hunting? Or... Rachel urged Pablo forward, letting him take his lead, but coaxing him into a canter, and then a full gallop as she became more certain of the direction. The horse was fast, and it raced along the blacktop. Rachel strained to hear above the sounds of his hooves. The wind whipped through her hair and made her cloak billow out behind her. Another gunshot. Closer this time, much closer. She was almost there. She rounded a bend in the road at full speed and nearly slammed right into a mass of orcs. Pablo reared, hooves flailing, kicking back the arms of the dead that turned to attack them, giving Rachel a split second to pull her sword, one hand clinging tight to the pommel of the saddle. She swung the blade, slicing through an orc and kicking it back. There were more orcs that she could easily count, most of them attacking what seemed to be an old, broken-down bus, its sides caked with old blood and dirt, fingers clawing against grimy metal, trying to get whatever was inside of there. Was there anything inside of there? She couldn't hear any sounds, not over the sounds of the dead, but the gunshot had to come from somewhere. Her horse bolted as an orc attacked from their right, nearly unsaddling her as she clung tightly with her knees, keeping her grip on the sword, swinging it as best she could at the dead, but more focused on trying to stay on as claw-like hands tried to grab onto her legs or saddle. "Stay alive," she could hear Brett's voice in her mind, though if it was a memory or her imagination, she wasn't sure.
"I'm not dying here,"
she growled to herself under her breath as Pablo turned sharply, ears flat against his head. She reined him in, trying to get him back under some semblance of control. He didn't want to be here, and she didn't want to either. It would be better to leave this place, leave the dead for whatever they were after. She was turning him to go, to keep riding far away from this place when she heard it. The terrified wail of a child. Rachel's heart dropped. There were kids on the bus. Every ounce of flight reflex was gone, every ounce of self-preservation. Now she had a mission, something she needed to do, someone to save. She might not be a superhero or the heroine of a book, but she was the only hero they had right now.
"I'm sorry, Pablo."
The horse's ears were flat on his head, eyes panicked.
"I know you want to run, but we have to do this. I know we can do this."
Most of the mass of dead was still distracted by the people inside the bus, their trapped prey. But Rachel was glad for that. A swarm of even 5 dead could overpower someone, and there were probably 20 or so, though it was hard to get an exact count. They were all slow, stained and tattered clothing falling off of bone and flesh. They all seemed a unified rust color as they moved, not individual people, but a large mass of monsters. This was life or death now, the big bad boss at the end of the level. She was staring it in the face, and there was no escape. She would have to fight.
"I am Arwen and Eowyn. I am Alana and Arya,"
she yelled out loud to an unresponsive mass of the dead, raising her sword above her head as if she were inspiring an army to charge into battle.
"I am Sif. I am Xena."
She took a breath, trying to gather her courage.
"I am Rachel. I am a warrior, and I am not afraid."
Squeezing Pablo's sides, she urged him forward, charging down at an orc that had turned to respond to her yelling. Her sword sang through the air, the crunch of splitting bone as the sword pierced the skull and the body collapsed. Her horse seemed to understand what she was thinking and kept to the edge, dancing out of the reach of the snapping, grabbing hands that were now turning their attention to her instead of the bus.
As he ran, a handful of the orcs turned to follow, giving Rachel the time to slice and stab, dropping their bodies and turning her attention to the next ones that came through. There were five down now, but the horde kept coming. Rachel was losing track. She felt like she had already killed more than a dozen, but there never seemed to be an end to this mass of bodies. She had no idea how many she had actually killed. All she knew was that she needed to keep going. Her arm hurt, and her hand was slippery from the sticky black blood of the dead. She clenched her fingers tighter around the hilt of the dagger. Any mistake meant her death. She knew that. An orc grabbed onto her leg, teeth attaching to her boot as she tried to kick them away, dragging her out of the saddle as it pulled her down. She yelled, whether from fear or surprise or as a war cry, she wasn't sure, driving the dagger down through its skull with such force that she fell as the body crumpled, carrying her blade and her with it, as another orc latched its teeth onto Pablo, ripping a gash into his side as the horse let out something akin to a scream. More orcs diving for his legs, teeth driving into the soft flesh they found there. She hit the ground hard as Pablo fell, the air driving from her lungs as she rolled, trying to jump back up to her feet. The horde was split, half of the orcs still continuing their assault on the bus, the others stumbling towards her, yellow teeth gnashing. One grabbed onto her forearm, teeth sinking into the thick leather. She swung her sword jerkily, ribs protesting, and she missed the skull, sinking her sword into the base of the neck. Wincing, she let go of the sword, using the hand to grab a dagger out of her belt and sinking that into the weak part of the skull at the top of the head of the orc, which dropped hard. Okay, this was bad. This was so very, very bad. Pablo's panicked cries continued, but Rachel couldn't look at him, so instead her eyes fixed on the next body that lunged at her. Her eyes tracked the bodies, trying to figure out the best way to clear them without backing herself into a corner she couldn't get out of. There wasn't time to try to retrieve her sword, so instead she turned to face the next orc in a half-crouch, jumping to the side as it tried to lunge at her, turning in midair to drive the knife into the back of the head at the base of the skull. There were only three left coming, and she backed up a few steps, trying to judge which to take first. One came at her from the side, and she dodged it, shoving its shoulder and using its stumble to grab onto the shirt and drive the blade between the eyes. Using a well-placed kick to the chest to knock the next one to the ground, she dispatched it with a quick stab. The last one's hands tried to grab hold of her, clumsy fingers attaching to a loop on her armor and pulling her towards its teeth. With a cry, she switched hands on the knife, driving it hard into the side of the orc's forehead. Her chest was heaving, ribs sending sharp warning pains as she moved. She ached everywhere already, but there was no time to wait. Pablo had fallen silent, and Rachel didn't want to look. She couldn't look. She wouldn't have been able to handle it if she did. Squeezing her eyes shut for a moment, she swallowed down her emotions. Heroes couldn't cry, not when there were people to save. Another gunshot rang out across the road, followed by the agonized screaming that Rachel had come to associate with death. Her heart sunk, and using her foot as leverage, she pulled the sword out of the orc's neck from where it had lodged, ignoring the protests in her side. Sprinting forward, she sliced through the back of the head of an orc that had turned to follow the screaming, and kept going. She couldn't see anything from this side of the bus, and she ducked around the back of the bus, hoping that most of the dead would be on the other end. Slicing her sword through the side of the head of another orc, she rushed toward the man that was laying at the foot of the door of the bus, still screaming, as two orcs dug their teeth and nails into him. The blood was everywhere. Rachel felt nauseous, but she swallowed it down, driving her dagger into the heads of the orcs one by one, shoving their bodies to the side. The man wouldn't stop screaming, clawing at the bites on his neck, and Rachel knew what she had to do.
"I'm sorry," she whispered before driving the knife up through the side of his skull.
Then it was silent. Rachel had the unnerving feeling tickling on the back of her neck that she was being watched.
12. Dez Fox. Dez had spent a lot of time hunting the forests of western Pennsylvania and northern Maryland. She understood the woods as well as any experienced hunter. She had also hunted men in Afghanistan during the war. Being a soldier, a hunter, and a cop had taught her a lot about how to read what the land wanted to share. In a police academy forensics class, she'd also learned that contact always leaves a mark. Tracking, then, was looking for marks. Mankind itself made marks on the world. Roads, buildings, cultivated fields, and more. These impositions on the land were mostly overgrown and eventually would fade, but that created a different kind of pattern, a different kind of trail. Where weeds and new growth grew, it spoke to a lack of use, and in some places it was crystal clear to Dez that no foot, living or dead, had come this way in months. Elsewhere, the weeds were bent and broken, or pushed aside. The passage of random passage suggested a single person using that route infrequently. Crushed foliage told a story of heavier and more frequent use. Dez could read the stories of each. A careful living person, even one trying not to be seen and making maximum use of natural cover, still left tracks that showed they were in control of their bodies. The steps were more orderly, more evenly spaced. Dead feet tended to wander, to drag, to ignore cover and follow the path of least resistance. There was evidence of both kinds of travelers in the woods. Twice she spotted zombies standing in the forests doing nothing. It was a phenomena she'd begun to realize was a thing. Unless drawn by scent, sight, or sound, the dead would often slow to a stop and simply stand there. When the dead moved in packs, the movement of the whole tended to draw the others, but Dez figured that even these groups would eventually slow down when the ones out front had nothing new to chase. It made a weird sense to her. After all, why would they just keep moving? Zombies were opportunistic hunters. They attacked and devoured life, animals, humans, birds, and they had already begun stripping areas of everything that could feed them. In the absence of prey, they stopped, no longer pulled by their senses. That created a new kind of danger. The motionless zombies were like landmines and IEDs. They could be anywhere, and because they remained so still and so quiet, it was easy to walk right past one and accidentally trigger its appetite and aggression. Dez paused in her search long enough to cut a green branch from a tree. She used a knife to strip the leaves and bark from it and to trim it down to a 20-inch length with a sturdy Y at one end. She held that in her left hand and carried her blackjack in the other. That gave her a formidable set of tools for a technique she wished she could patent and sell. She'd be a millionaire with the first post-apocalypse must-have invention. Great for Christmas, perfect for stocking stuffers, she mused. She had to use it less than 2 miles from the bus. As she cut along an overgrown fire access road, a solo zombie suddenly lurched toward her from the shade of an oak. One moment it was invisible, merely part of the landscape, and then next it snarled and lunged at her, gray fingers clawing at her shirt and hair. Dez backpedaled to get her footing, set her weight on the balls of her feet, and as the creature shambled forward, she used both weapons to slap its reaching arms down and then thrust the Y-stick hard against its throat. The mouth of the Y snugged in tight under the chin of that snapping mouth, and Dez quickly moved close and brought the blackjack down on the crown of the monster's head. The blackjack was made from a heavy pellet of lead wrapped in leather. The weapon's neck was flexible, which allowed for a lot of snapping speed. Handled one way, and it would deliver a soft, penetrating blow that would render a criminal dazed or unconscious, often with a mild concussion. Used any other way, it crushed bone and drove splinters through dura mater and into the brain. There was a reason it had been outlawed by police forces across America, just as there was a reason Dez Fox had taken it out of the box of weapons she'd kept in her trailer home when everything was falling apart. She'd nearly lost her job for using it once while busting up a biker gang brawl. Now she was glad she hadn't thrown it away. The blackjack whipped through the air and hit the zombie on the crown with enough force to send a shockwave up Dez's arm. She knew from hard, bad experience that it wasn't any trauma to the brain that stopped one of the dead. The blow had to do significant damage to the motor cortex or the brainstem. So as the creature dropped to its knees, Dez used the Y-stick to set it for the killing blow. Another swing, another crunch, and then the zombie was a ragdoll. Dead for sure. And forever. She stepped aside and let it fall. The creature had been a forest ranger once. She could see that from his pants and shoes
and the few remaining tatters of shirt that clung to the destroyed body.
"I'm sorry," she murmured as she stepped away.
And she was sorry. Hard and brutal as she was, as she'd become,